it's quite alarming. You see, what I do is I strap my tripod into the kayak with a gimbal sat in front of me and this big, you know, long white 200 to 400 lens sat there, which is a rather expensive piece of equipment. So it's quite a jarring image when people see that.
From thedigitaltrekker.com, I'm Matt Brandon, and this is Depth of Field, the podcast about working photographers. And my guest today is Dan Carr. Dan is a adventure photographer. Would you call yourself that? Or how do you describe it? What it is? You're commercial.
I guess I get this question a lot, actually. And as the years go on, I find it harder and harder to define as I branch out into different things. But I think, yes, adventure is a good place to start. Anything that is outdoors, makes my skin crawl to think about being in a studio or shooting weddings or anything like that. So it's anything that's outdoors, and it usually involves some kind of adventure.
Right. Now I hear a British accent there, but you're in Whistler, right? In British Columbia.
Yes, that's right.
Not that you can't be someplace other than your accent. You
know? No, but I have a bit of a messed up accent now, I think, because I have lived in Canada for just over 10 years now. I'm originally from England, grew up there and did all my education over there. And shortly after I'd finished that, I moved out to Canada. So I have this bit of a mix of an accent going on now that a lot of people find hard to place.
Have you gotten the A down yet? You know, the Canadian A?
You know, it's I think it's one of those things. People don't actually say it that much. it's kind of like a myth, like that all English people just drink tea.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's one of those things.
Well, it's one of those things where there are people that do it because there are people that drink tea. I know that. Yeah. You know. Anyway, so we first came into contact with each other through Pro Photo Coalition. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I'd forgotten how we made that initial contact, actually. Yeah.
I was writing a blog with them, and you were actually in charge of it or something, weren't you?
Yeah, that was a website which in its current form is a little bit different. Pro Photo Coalition was kind of a sister website to a very popular and still popular video production website called Pro Video Coalition. Mm-hmm. And they had this arm of the site called Pro Photo Coalition, and I was the editor of that. So yeah, we had you on board writing some articles for that. I'm not involved with that company anymore. I've since gone off and sort of concentrated on my own things, but Pro Video Coalition is still very much a popular website on the video production side of things.
Yeah, and that's the same with me. I mean, I have been asked to write blog posts for them, for New York Institute of Photography, on several others, and it's hard to keep coming up with content when you do, you want to put it on your site.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah, that's exactly what I found is when you start weighing things up, there's a great value to having content on your own website these days. So when you start putting it on other websites, it can be problematic if you're really trying to drive traffic to your own site for one reason or another.
Yeah, I guess they have to really make it financially worthwhile to be able to do that. And I haven't found that these sites, I mean, they're fair, but it's not, I don't know. I don't want to talk against them, but I just haven't felt like it made it worthwhile. Let me put it like that.
Yeah. It is difficult. I mean, I've done some writing just this past year for dpreview.com as well, which is a pretty large site. And some of those larger sites, they have more of that possibility to tempt you into writing stuff on their site, definitely. But it's hard for the smaller sites. Yeah.
Well, dpreview, I think I wrote one post for them one time, and I think I got like 10,000 hits off of it or something on my site just because of a link on my site. So that's the kind of thing that's well worth it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, let's get back to you. Let's talk about photography and stuff. So when and where did you start shooting? Was it something you'd done as a kid or how did it happen?
You know, it's when I was growing up, my dad had a Canon film SLR, an AE-1, I think it was. And he always used to let me shoot with it. So I had a bit of a feeling for it when I was younger, but at the time I didn't have any intention of making it my career. Mm-hmm. I didn't own my own camera for a long time. When it really started for me was when I moved to Canada. I moved just after I finished university. I hadn't planned for it to be a move. It was supposed to be a temporary vacation. And so I finished up at university and I was going to come over here for a year or so and do that thing where people come and work in a ski resort for a year and let their hair down, have some fun, and then go back to the real world and take right. a job in their trained profession.
A gap year after your university.
Yes. And I did a gap year before university, which is actually the first time I came to Whistler on that gap year there. And that's what sort of got me familiar with the place. Mm-hmm. And so after I'd finished university, I decided to come back for one last year of fun and do some skiing and snowboarding and that kind of stuff. And just before I left for that trip, I decided that I wanted to take some photos to be sending back to show my friends and family basically how cool the place was and what a good time I was having. And this was been round about the time when things like Facebook were starting to pop up. And so you had this kind of instant way of sharing what was going on in your life with people. Mm-hmm. And I went on eBay and I bought myself my first DSLR. So I used my dad's old film SLR, but I never had one myself. My first camera, proper camera myself, was the Canon 10D. So this was one of Canon's earlier, I think right. it was about their third or fourth digital.
An 8-megapixel camera or something like that?
I'm trying to remember if it was 6 or 8. It was one of the two.
Yeah.
They had the D30, the D60, and then the 20. Yeah, then the 10D. And yeah, so I think it was maybe 6, but possibly 8. And, at the time, that was great. Mm. I just grabbed one lens, which I think I got on eBay as well. And that was really the beginning. I didn't know at the time that this was going to kick things off. But I also, importantly, dragged a friend of mine from university out to Whistler with me. He was a sort of semi-professional skier in his part-time back in the UK. And when I was at university with him, we would spend a lot of our time darting off to Europe to go ski in the Alps and things like that whenever we had a spare moment. And I was heavily involved with all the snow sports associations at university. I was captain of the university snowboarding team and that kind of stuff. So we were off competing at various places all the time. And I got to know this guy and dragged him over to Whistler with me. And he was a pretty crazy skier. He was one of these people that doesn't think twice about throwing himself off a fairly decent sized cliff. And that's not for me at all. I'm quite happy to watch people do that. But I always had my camera with me. So this eBay purchased camera was the beginning of everything. And I started carrying it around with me when I was skiing with him and some of our other friends. And, while they would do their thing, I would take some photos of it without really thinking about it too much. It certainly still wasn't an idea of a profession or anything like that. But I didn't realize it at the time, but that was the beginning of it right there. And it kind of...
Did you do anything with those photos of him?
I did. And I forget the story of exactly how it happened, but somehow I was contacted by a local Whistler magazine to say, hey, can you send us some of these photos to use in the magazine? And back then, the thought never occurred to me that I should ask for money for that kind of thing. And I said, sure, yeah. I sent them 3 or 4 photos. And then a couple of months later, the magazine came out, and one of my photos was the cover of this magazine.
Whoa, a cover shot right off the bat.
Right, yeah. And it was just a little local Whistler, free magazine. You pick up the grocery store kind of thing. But I saw that, and that was a real spark right there, because I saw that and I thought, wow, that's pretty cool. I could get used to this.
You just got bit.
Yeah, and a couple of other photos were used in that issue as well. And I thought, this is, I wonder if this is a thing. Like, do people do this as a job? So I started to look into it. And at the time, I still was pretty wary of deciding to go down that path because I'd just finished a degree in aerospace engineering, of all things. That was what I was planning on going back to England to do. I was going to specialize in designing race cars. Motorsports was my thing. And I was aiming to go into Formula One and work with that kind of stuff. So it would have been a pretty big, well, it was a big change in the end for me to make that decision to kind of ditch all that training I'd just completed and decide to go down the photography path. But I kind of stuck with it for a little bit to see where it would take me. I remember going to a workshop that they held in Whistler with a couple of really big names in the sort of adventure and action sports photography arena at the time. And I just sat and listened to them for a while and started to think more and more that this was a potentially something I would like to do. So I committed all my spare time to it whenever I wasn't working my day job back then, to basically chasing this guy around, and some other friends that, we'd hang out with that were equally crazy and just start to really teach myself how all this stuff worked.
So are you self-taught on all this, or did you end up going back to and taking classes and things like that?
100% self-taught. Yeah. I basically learned everything off the internet, and through a process of kind of self-critique of my own work and then making a conscious effort as well to kind of critique the stuff that I found in magazines as well. So I would go on the internet, and it's tricky to learn stuff off the internet sometimes because there's so much there, and the skill is really in trying to figure out what stuff is true and what stuff you should take as gold and which stuff you need to ignore. So I kind of tried to figure that out, and I was always buying a lot of magazines that had the kind of photography in that I was interested in, and I would sit there and I would find the shots that I liked and the shots that I didn't like. And then I would sort of mentally dissect the ones that I did like and say, okay, why do I like that shot?
Interesting.
Were
you able to look at things like camera angle? Well, I guess you can look at camera angle, but what about like lighting and things like that? I guess that is more tough.
The early part of my career, I got very quickly into using external lighting. I would do a lot of complex action sports setups with 6, 7, 8 different strobes at a time. So I was really into that technical side of things. And I think that came from the fact that I have an engineer's brain. You know, I've just done this aerospace engineering degree. I'm a bit of a tech kind of guy.
People say that they're in photography. We have two types of photographers. You have the geek and the artist. And so you fit into the geek side of things, I guess, right?
I think that's probably true. Yeah, I mean, I like to think there's some artist in there as well, but
it's not exclusive. You know, no. I'm not trying to say you can't be both, but you kind of come from one of those angles.
Absolutely, and I definitely came from that techie side of things.
Yeah.
And I would analyze the lighting. I would look at other people's lights, and you can usually tell. You just look at the shadows. You look at the strength of the shadows, how harsh they are, and you can figure out the relative powers of people's flashes, you know, figure out where the key light was coming from, if the harder shadow was going to be opposite the subject to the key light. And, you know, I would mentally draw these lines across images and figure out where people had placed their flashes. Like, it got down to that kind of detail. So I would dissect all of that stuff. And the funny thing is that Whistler is... in the ski industry, it's a very well-known place. We have incredible terrain here. The ski resort here wins best ski resort in North America pretty much every year. And because of that, we have a lot of other photographers and athletes gravitate to this area. So I was picking up these skiing magazines and snowboarding magazines and dissecting this work like this, but most of the photographers, or a large number of the photographers that I was looking at, were also from Whistler. They were all living there as well. There was a huge number of them all in this one tiny town. So that was kind of an interesting thing.
Did that thought cross your mind that maybe was a bad move to move there? I mean, I guess it wasn't, but did, you know, I would think that you don't go where, you know, where everybody else is. You want to try to find someplace else.
it crossed my mind. It crossed other people's mind a lot more, I think, because people would always ask me that. And the way I took it was I fell in love with the place first and then the profession. So I wasn't going to change where I wanted to live. You know, one thing led to another. You know, the place definitely spawned the profession in the end. It's kind of sparked my interest in photography, having this beautiful scenery around here and also these people around here that live this lifestyle of kind of crazy mountain sports antics. But, you know, Whistler and British Columbia was where I wanted to be. So I wasn't going to change that. So okay. Instead of that, I just took the approach that I had to be very aware of that problem. And I had to come up with some ideas to help get around it. Rather than just saying, yeah, this is going to be a problem. Let's move on and find something that isn't a problem. I just looked for ways to solve it, looked at the way people were running their businesses and tried to do something a little bit different, tap into a market from a slightly different angle. And I think because I was aware of it, it was something that I considered quite a lot. It ended up not being a problem. Yeah.
Okay. So now do you shoot... I know you shoot skiing and other winter sports, things like this. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you do some, I don't know if it's F1. I'm not that familiar with the difference between them, but I know you do some motorsports.
Yeah, some motorsports. Yeah, I've done that stuff. Yeah. I mean, I generalize it with motorsports because I've shot a few different things within that genre. So. That's just a passion of mine that comes from my education. You know, I was ending to right. be the other side of the camera on that situation and not be the driver, but at least be the engineer behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So I've always had a passion for that and tried to photograph some of that whenever I get the chance.
Does it give you an edge, you think, knowing some of that stuff?
I think you always have an edge if you have a deep understanding and passion for your subject. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are two things that I'm pretty keen on, you know, impressing on people when I'm teaching photography these days is to at least start by looking at the stuff that you're really passionate about. Mm-hmm. You know, with the skiing side of things as well, I think I had an edge there because I understand the sport a lot as well. The skiing and snowboarding side of things, I understand that. And I think, yeah, that kind of stuff always gives you an edge. Yeah.
Okay. So what other things are you photographing?
I mean, recently I've actually been on a bit of a wildlife photography kick as well. It's something I guess one of the things I love about photography is there are always more avenues to explore. Right. And I decided after about 6 or 7 years of just doing the ski photography stuff, I decided I wanted to branch out and I loved what I was doing, but I was getting called the ski photographer, which didn't, you know, I didn't help myself there because I had a website called theskiphotographer.com at the time. So I brought that on myself, but I realized that there was so many other things that I wanted to shoot. So I really started to try and find ways to get out there and shoot different things and just learn about other aspects of photography. So most recently, I've been really trying to get my wildlife photography stuff going on. And I started that kind of journey about a year and a half ago. Bought a super telephoto lens so that I didn't get eaten by the wildlife around here.
I think I saw your unboxing of that.
Right. Yes. The 200, Canon 200 to 400 with the built-in extender is the one that I got.
Right. That's a F4.
Yeah, it's F4 for 200 to 400, and then it has a switch on the side that adds in a 1.4 extender, and that makes it F5.6. Okay. So you have like a 200 to 560 mil lens, basically.
Now, I don't really want to get into gear talk too much here, mm-hmm. but having shot with extenders and stuff, I realize how soft it makes the lens. When it's built into the camera like that, does it soften the lens up?
No, it's still fantastic with the extender because each one is calibrated for that lens because it's built into it. So it's designed, you know, just as another group within the lens. And that makes a big difference. So it's really, you know, I have no qualms about engaging the extender when I need to, apart from you lose that stop of light. So you need to be in a situation where you have enough light to do that. But in terms of image sharpness, there's a small hit, but nothing really perceivable unless you're really pixel peeping.
Okay. And then most of the places you're shooting, it's bright outside unless you're shooting evening or something. I mean,
You know, it's actually, this I think is one of the biggest things I discovered when I started the wildlife photography stuff, was just actually how dark the situation is when you're shooting a lot of the time. The first wildlife trip that I went on was to go and shoot grizzly bears up north in British Columbia here. Mm-hmm. And I set off on this trip without really knowing too much about the wildlife side of things. I'd had the lens for a while because I knew it was something I wanted to get into, but it's also a great sports photography lens. So I've been using it for all kinds of other things. And this was the first chance that I really got out to shoot wildlife for it intensively. I mean, I'd done a day here, a few hours here and there when stuff had appeared in front of me, but this was a specific trip, you know, with the intention of just shooting grizzly bears for a week. And I quickly realized that it's usually almost dark when they come out to eat and do, you know, most of their activities. So even at F4, you know, you can be shooting at ISO 3200 and still getting less than a hundredth of a second shutter speed. When you're shooting at a very long length, like 560 millimeters, then you got to make sure that you've got some pretty good stabilization and your long lens technique is good. And I compounded that problem by the fact that I was shooting from a kayak.
I was going to say, I bet you're shooting from a boat of some sort too on grizzlies. Yeah.
Yeah. So I rigged up a kayak. When I set out to do the trip, I wanted to do something a little bit different. I wanted to really immerse myself in the scenery up there and get some photos that looked like I was a part of their world rather than just looking in on it from the outside. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes there's a tendency to stay a little bit, I don't want to say too safe, but shooting from a position above looking down on wildlife, sometimes just you get that kind of feeling that's similar to just being in a zoo looking down on their world. And I wanted to be very much a part of it and get a different angle. So I did some research and found a kayak that would be, I thought, stable enough to handle my tripod setup. I ended up buying a fishing kayak for this trip. So I bought this kayak specifically for this trip. This all sounds rather elaborate, but it ended up being well worth it. So I bought this fishing kayak, and a fishing kayak is, it kind of has a double hull design on it, so it's extra stable because they're designed so a fisherman can stand up in them and cast their rod.
Okay.
So it's just basically a bit of a wider kayak, but it has a double hull kind of catamaran underside to it, which really helps the stability. For anyone that wants to look up the specific model, because I do get this question quite a lot, it's a Wilderness Systems Commander 120. So I get that question so much when people see the photo of this setup, because it's quite alarming. You see, what I do is I strap my tripod into the kayak with a gimbal sat in front of me and this big, you know, long white 200 to 400 lens sat there, which is a rather expensive piece of equipment. So it's quite a jarring image when people see that, and they ask the questions, do you ever wonder if you're going to flip it over and drench your whole setup? So the next question is always, what kind of kayak is that then, if you're that confident in it?
I would assume, Dan, the next question was, what's your insurance like?
Yes, I mean, I definitely have insurance. I'm not sure I'm too specific about why I need it with them, but So I strapped this tripod into the kayak and put the gimbal on there and have this lens there, and that allows me to float in front of the grizzly bears but really be down on a low level with them. So you get that sort of eye line shot, which makes it feel like you're in the water with them while they're fishing for the salmon, or lying on the side of the lake with them.
But you still have a nice getaway.
You have something of a getaway, yes. That's kind of was definitely in the back of my mind when I was coming up with this situation. I think I've since been in situations where I've been on land and shot some of them. Now that I'm a bit more comfortable working around those kind of bears, but certainly at the time, a getaway plan was part of the reason for that.
But you're still floating. I mean, it's still, I mean, no matter how stable you can, I mean, even if you were on a raft, you're not going to flip over, but it's still floating.
Yes. Stability is definitely a problem. And you sort of have to, you have to look at the eddies in the current and find those spots where the water actually kind of spins and gets static in a small area. Mm-hmm. If you pull out into the current, then yeah, it's very hard to shoot. As I was saying, you end up with very slow shutter speeds at dusk and dawn when these bears come out to fish for salmon. And
so what was the slowest you were able to shoot while using a kayak?
I got some shots as low as a 60th of a second. Wow. But it's definitely a pretty low keeper rate at that point. It's I was much more confident around a 100th, 120, that kind of area.
That's still really good for something that's floating.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason is the gimbal really helps because the gimbal allows the camera to be kind of free floating there. So I'm not putting any of my energy into supporting this big heavy setup. I can push the thing around with my finger. And I guess it says a lot for the image stabilization on that lens as well. It's a four-stop stabilizer on that Canon lens. And it does a remarkable job, yeah.
So you've got the gimbal loose and you've got the stabilization going, and then so in a sense it's a little bit similar to Steadicam.
Right. Yes, it's something like that, apart from I guess it is it is relatively like that, yeah.
Because everything else is moving and the camera's kind of floating there.
Yeah, the camera's kind of floating there, and that's my aim, is to just use the slightest touch just to keep the camera pointing in the right direction, yeah, and try not to, you know, often the kayak will be floating away and turning, and I'll just try and, you know, focus on keeping the lens straight. So sometimes my body's getting contorted as the kayak's spinning around, but I'm just focused on really keeping the lens in the same direction. And then I'll get maybe 10 seconds of shooting, and then I can let go of the camera. I mean, this is the other great thing. When the camera's on the gimbal and you let go of it, it stays balanced in exactly the same spot. So I can let go of it for 2 seconds, grab my paddle, do a couple of paddle strokes to turn the kayak back around again, and then pick up the camera, and it's, you know, exactly where I left it. So I've always got that ability to just let go.
It is very much like a Steadicam in that sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So did you have to make any quick exits?
No, I was surprised how fixated the bears are once they start their fishing. It really is all about the salmon for them. once they're in food mode, as long as you keep your distance and stay respectful of their their space, then they're relatively easy to work with. I was pleasantly surprised
by that.
In terms of distance, or I mean, I guess something around 30 to 40 feet, I would be able to get within that kind of distance with that lens. You know, that's roughly where you would start to be getting the bear filling a large portion of the frame with that kind of focal length. And once they're fishing, as long as you don't, you know, if you want to be careful, if it's a mother and cubs, and the
right
rule number one, don't go near them, or definitely don't get between them. And, you know, never make them feel like they're boxed into any kind of situation. As long as they feel like they have space to move along, then they do. And also not spending a huge amount of time with, one specific animal, give them their space and move on. I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, I think in that first trip, the only time I had a heart racing moment was actually one of the couple of times when I did shoot on the land. And we were walking through the woods to an area where we thought there would be some bears, and there was four grizzlies just around the corner. Once we came around to this deserted house in the forest, there was four grizzlies there, and one of them bluff charged us, which is, you know, something they do to start where they don't have an intention of following through with it at that point, but you don't know that.
No. And you have to change your underwear.
Yeah. So that had me reaching for my bear spray on my belt for a second or two. But that was it. You know, he was really just letting us know that he didn't want us to come any closer. We respected that, and there was no problem. So that was my first wildlife photography experience. And I mean, it was so successful photographically, and also from a business point of view as well.
I was going to ask you, were you able to then monetize that trip?
Yes, and this was what was kind of eye-opening about this for me, was I think I really kind of fell into another area, which I guess I was maybe destined to be in for a little bit longer. It's been one of my most successful photography trips that I've ever done. And considering it was my first proper wildlife photography trip, that really surprised me. Because I didn't have at the time a plan on where I might sell these. I was really treating it as like a learning trip, you know, learning mm-hmm. about working amongst these kind of animals, learning about just wildlife photography in general. It was really a learning experience. And I didn't have plans to sell them specifically, but I ended up selling them to some photography magazines, wildlife magazines, local British Columbian magazines. Some of them were used by Adobe recently on one of their iPad apps as well. And just, I think the idea of the whole kayak setup as well added this level of interest that brought a lot of attention to me as well. I had a decent amount of media attention from that, people doing interviews with me in magazines. And there was a thing in PDN a couple of months ago with a photo of my kayak setup and some of the bear photos from that trip as well. It really sparked some interest from people with that, you know, kind of interesting kayak setup. So it's something that I know that I'm going to pursue a lot more. And I have been since that as well. I've been back and shot quite a lot more wildlife this year. And I've been back to those same grizzly bears as well, and kind of continued that experience with them.
Yeah, I'm looking at that shot of the of you and your kayak with that lens with that on that gimbal. It's I can see why it's rather disturbing if you're a photographer looking at that.
Yes, you'll have to include that in the show notes, because it does fascinate people, that one. Yeah. And I've never had an experience where I've even come close to getting it wet. What I do when I get the most dangerous part is getting in and out of the kayak. That's when you're most likely to tip it over. Once I'm sitting in there, it's pretty stable. So I have a dry bag, and I put the lens and the camera in a dry bag and put it in the kayak first. And then once I'm out on the water, I take it out of the dry bag and put it on the gimbal. And that's my safety routine right there, because yeah, getting in and out of the kayak is definitely the chance you have, you know, you put a foot wrong here and slip on, you fall on the side of the kayak, and that's when you're most likely to tip it over.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, I see a whole list of clients here on your website, and these are pretty big names. So how does that come about?
A lot of the, I guess, people like Red Bull, Oakley, and those companies like that are often associated with the action sports photography and adventure sports market. Most of the initial contact I got with those companies was working directly with their sponsored athletes. So when I, just going back to the problem that I found myself in being in Whistler with a bunch of other photographers in the same market, I realized that I needed to find my own athletes to work with. That's really the key. Everyone ends up with kind of their group of athletes. So I started from the bottom, and I looked for up and coming athletes that I thought were going to do well in the snow sports industry. And I worked with a lot of those people. And then my business grew as their careers grew. You know, they changed their sponsors, moved up to bigger companies, got bigger paychecks from bigger companies. And a lot of my work came with with that kind of thing.
So if a skier is sponsored by Red Bull and Red Bull says, "Hey, I love the shot of Joe Blow, the skier. We'd like to buy that shot." Then you've all of a sudden you've got Red Bull as a client now.
Yeah, and I guess making contact with the companies. I mean, a lot of people think that might be a hard thing to do, but actually getting in touch with the right people in some of those companies isn't maybe as tricky as people imagine. Because if you work with the athletes, I guess the first thing you have to realize is that these companies, there's only certain people whose images they're going to want to use in their ads. From an athlete perspective, I mean, they don't care who the photographer is, but from an athlete perspective, they pay some athletes an awful lot of money to use their equipment or drink their drinks or, you know, whatever, wear their logo on their helmet or skis or snowboard, whatever it is. And those are the only people that they're really ever going to spend any money buying images of. But you also have to think about how that business works, because these athletes are being paid by these companies essentially to get media coverage. Magazine advertising and stuff like that is really expensive for these companies. So they pay these athletes to be brand ambassadors, but also to be out there getting their images taken and put in magazines. So if they work with these photographers, people like me who can get their images in a large magazine, for every image they get, a full page image in a magazine, that full page ad might have cost them $5,000 to $10,000 for that company to buy that ad. So part of an athlete's job really is to go out there and get themselves media coverage. So they're actively looking for photographers to work with a lot of the time. And if you can convince them that your work is good enough and that you're not going to miss the shot when they do something that they only ever want to do once in their life, I mean, that's kind of an important thing. If you can convince them that you're going to get the shot, then athletes are always looking to have their photos taken. And then the important part after that is that once they have their photo taken, they're really excited to show their company those photos because it shows that they've been doing their job. So once you have the great shot, they then need to show that shot to the company to say, "Hey, look, I'm out there doing my thing. I'm doing my job." So of course they want to send that shot to the company. So once you have the shot, getting it to their company like Oakley, Red Bull, Salomon, all these big brands in that sort of outdoor sports market is relatively easy because the athletes really want to make sure these brands know they've been out there taking these photos.
So how do you monetize that? Do you just charge the athlete? How does that work?
The typical situation would be you would send some low resolution photos to the athlete and say you can pass these on to your team manager. You know, if I have more of a relationship with them, then I'll ask for the contact detail of the team manager and I'll make that contact myself. And that's really the first port of call is the team manager. That's the person between the athlete and the marketing department, basically. So this is the guy that's in charge of making sure, you know, they have enough athletes to represent their brand and that they're out there doing their job. So the team manager.
Now, that's interesting. Yeah. I would have thought you would have gone to the agent.
Of the athlete?
Of the athlete, yeah.
A lot of these athletes don't have agents.
That's surprising.
Yeah, only the very, very top ones have agents in the action sports market. So out of all the people I've ever worked with, I would say only 10% of them have actually had an agent. And even then, I've dealt directly with the company. I mean, I want to get my photos to the company as fast as possible. And that would usually mean circumnavigating any kind of agent. It's because there's no issues with using the likeness of an athlete for commercial purposes if it's with the brand that they're sponsored by. So within their own contracts, these athletes sign, it's understood that their likeness, you know, can be used for commercial purposes. I would go to the agent if I was trying to sell an image to let's just say a car company came to me and said, hey, we want to use this more sort of generic action sports shot and it has this athlete in it, then that's a situation where we'd have to get some model releases signed and everyone's got to be very clear on this, and I'd go to the agent in that situation. But if the athlete already has a contract with a company, that contract already covers, you know, them, their likeness being used for advertising purposes. So there's really no need to go to an agent if they had one, which mostly they don't.
So it's a little bit like if that athlete's going to endorse a product, other than what they have a contract for, as far as like Red Bull or something like that, mm-hmm. then you'd have to go to the agent, because that agent got that Red Bull contract for him.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, you talk to the team manager, and then if they like the shots, then ask them to pass it on to the marketing department or ask for the contact of the marketing department. And you know, if they want to use a shot for anything, then they'll come back to me, and then I'll just find out what kind of stuff they want to use it for. And at that point, we'll start talking, you know, quotation on for licensing and how much money we're going to get.
Now, do you use any kind of software or anything to figure out costs for this stuff?
Yes, I have. I use PhotoQuote. I'm not sure how many programs there are out there. I don't think there's too many. So if you've asked that question before, I would say maybe a few people have said PhotoQuote.
Well, PhotoShelter has a little bit of a, in fact, I think the engine is from PhotoQuote.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's as detailed. I mean, I downloaded PhotoQuote. There's a trial version or something like that. And mm-hmm. it's quite complicated.
It is quite complicated. Yeah. Yeah. I found it very useful. Someone recommended it to me. Another action sports photographer recommended it to me right back at the beginning of my career. And they said,
it's not cheap either, right? So
no, exactly. And this is what they said. They said, you're going to look at the price to start with, and you're just getting started and you're not going to want to spend it, but it'll probably make you your money back in one, maybe two sales, because you will just get more money by understanding where you need to be pricing things. And he's absolutely right. I mean, it's paid for itself over and over again, just knowing where to begin with things. It's often not black and white that it'll spit out the exact right price. You have to kind of adapt things to the industry that you're working in, because every segment of photography is slightly different. A full page image in a high end fashion magazine isn't going to be the same price as it is for an action sports magazine. But once you figure out the relative difference between those two kind of things, that relativity stays the same for basically every, you know, image size and usage. So once you figure out, okay, PhotoQuote's telling me this price, in my industry I typically get 30% more or less than what it's suggesting, and then you apply that change to all the quotations it spits out, then it works really well. It actually has a built-in function where you can put in, okay, adapt all prices you think by, you know, X percentage. So if you do figure out, okay, I'm, you know, typically my specific niche gets me 10% under what you suggest, you can put that in there and it will adapt all the prices automatically to your industry once you've figured it out. So from that point onwards, I've always tried to stick to a pricing model. That's been really helpful. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you. You were actually saying, so then you figured out you were talking about the process of how you're monetizing this thing. You talk about it. Then you essentially look at your quote and you quote them a price, and, mm-hmm. and at that point it's just whether they do it or not or what.
Yeah. I mean, typically there's a bit of a back and forth between what kind of usage they want for it. Most of the time, the usage, at least on the action sports side of stuff, is a mixture of website usage, catalog usage, magazine advertising, and POP, point of purchase, which is kind of banners and stuff that you see in stores. So if you walk into a shop and there's a cabinet full of Oakley sunglasses, and in the back of that cabinet is a photo of one of their snowboarders or something like that, or a Red Bull fridge in a store and there's a picture of one of their athletes stuck to the side of the fridge, that's POP. That's a popular licensing options. So that would be the first question is, okay, what do you want to license the image for? And some of those, you know, within that you would, we'd ask some questions about sizing and, you know, print numbers if it's for magazine advertising, and that helps me craft the quotation. And then you'd ask a few questions about exclusivity. You know, do you want it commercially exclusive? Potentially, they want it commercially exclusive, but they don't mind editorial usage of it, because that essentially is more is free advertising for them. If they buy a shot to run it on the side of their, you know, their in-store advertising stuff, but I can also get it into a magazine as a full page photo, then that's just a win-win for everyone. So, sometimes it's commercially exclusive, but they don't mind editorial. And then you would agree on a licensing, term, you know, a year or 2 years, something like that as well. And that those, all those things put together is what, it's kind of the ingredients you need when you use a program like PhotoQuote to put together a quotation. And hopefully they say yes. Usually they don't say yes the first time. And there has to be a bit of a back and forth. You know, adjusting prices, adjusting the licensing a little bit, maybe take a couple of usages off the table if they don't have the budget for everything they're asking for. And yeah, hopefully get the green light at some point.
Okay. Now, the whole point of the show is talking to working photographers and kind of find out how, what are the ins and outs, how they get to where they are, you know, for people that may be hobbyists thinking of jumping that gap between being a hobbyist to being a working professional. But more and more we're seeing that photographers are making less money actually on the photo themselves and more through workshops and ebooks and things like this. How would you look at your income stream, and what would you say it's coming from?
Yeah, so that's a great point these days. It's certainly the case, and it's becoming more and more important to have lots of different streams to your income instead of just one big river. If you have a river, it can dry up in a heartbeat. I know that from firsthand, because it's quite a volatile market, the editorial side of things these days. And I did a lot of editorial work in the action sports industry. And so many times I would send off an invoice and I wouldn't hear from these people. And then a few months later, I might get an email saying this magazine has gone into filed Chapter 11. And, you know, if it's in Europe, they've gone bankrupt here and there's nothing you can do about it. And it's just, it's a really volatile market. So I started to see that I needed to broaden my horizons a little bit, make my income come from a few different places just in case one of these things dried up. And I think that is becoming a fairly important thing for people these days. So in terms of my business, it's pretty evenly split between sort of editorial, commercial, but also educational stuff these days. And I lump my website into that as well, where I put some educational content on there for people to consume. And then I have various advertising and affiliate things on the website, which brings in income. And
Does it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Big time. Yeah. Yeah, okay. that's definitely a feasible way for people to make income if they're willing to commit the time for it. It's not something you can decide one day, okay, I'd like to make some income from my photography website and then start that happening tomorrow. But you know, I have over 1,000 posts on my blog, and through affiliate programs, I make a decent income from that stuff. It's a pretty significant part of my income.
And affiliates to things like B&H Photo, Amazon, things like that, or specifically other people's ebooks, things like that.
I don't really do the affiliates to the ebooks. It's basically usually just simply talking about the gear that I use. So I will tell people how I took a photo, and then say this is the gear that I used to take that photo. Mm-hmm. And then provide people a link, say, if you'd like to buy this, you can buy it on Amazon or B&H. So that, and also just a kind of a static list of the equipment that I use on my website, has always been a pretty big you know, people love to know what kind of gear I use, and that's
I do. They like to comment on it too.
Yeah, everyone's always got a lens that they think is better, but that's okay. It's good to have conversations. So it's mostly just talking to people about the gear that I use, and I actually don't have any. I don't have a single company at the moment that pays me to use a specific piece of equipment.
I think there's very few of those. I'm a brand ambassador for Fuji out of Malaysia, though. Not a U.S. brand ambassador, but I'm often get emails from people, you know, with some snarky remark about, well, I'd shoot Fuji too if they gave me my gear. You get gear to use time and again to review and stuff, but then oftentimes you have to give it back or whatever. You might get a discount or something, but I think people misunderstand that it's not like this pipeline of free gear.
Yeah, absolutely. I have the same experience. You know, I'll say I took this photo with the Canon, this, that, or the other, and I'll get some snarky comment on there saying, I wish I got free Canon gear or something like that. And it's I've spent thousands and thousands of my own dollars on all this stuff, and I'm simply telling you what equipment I use because a lot of people are interested in that. It's not
Do believe in the gear. I mean, you know, it's like I shoot Fuji because I really like Fuji. I mean, obviously, I'm not gonna shoot a camera I don't like.
Well, exactly. That's it right there. I mean, it's we want something that we can rely on. And that's exactly the same thing. I mean, I obviously promote the brands that I, whose products I enjoy. I use a lot of camera bags from Mindshift Gear, for example. So I have an affiliate program and I talk about their bags whenever I use them, but they don't pay me to use their equipment, and I could easily just go and use another camera bag if I wanted to. And then I would promote that one. I mean, I'd tell people what's working for me at the time.
Okay. All right. We're going to end this. Otherwise we'll be talking all day. It's been really good. Hey, so obviously we just talked about your website, so people can find you at dancarphotography.com.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And, I always encourage people to find me on social media as well. Facebook, I'm Dan Carr Photo, and Instagram, I'm Dan Carr Photo as well. And those are probably my two most active social places. So, yeah, I'd love to hear from your listeners, and shoot me questions if you have anything. We covered so much in this chat here.
It's so fun. No, it's been good. All right. Well, Dan, thanks so much. It's been great to have a face to face with you. It's
absolutely.
You know, we met so many years ago online, and then have talked here and there on social media and things, but never really had a face to face like this. So it's been good.
Yeah.
Appreciate what you had to share as far as, I guess, really how to make it in the world of photography when it comes to adventure and the insights you've given there. I appreciate that. And I know people are going to find this another interesting depth of field for them. So
thank you, Matt. Yeah, you're very welcome. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
I hope you've enjoyed today's program. Dan and I covered so much that I couldn't even put it all in the podcast. I have another 20 minutes or so of material where Dan goes into details about SEO for photographers. I'm going to release this as premium material for you for a cost of only $1. You can find the link for this in the show notes, so be sure and check that out. I'd really love to hear from you. Give me your thoughts and comments about this show or others. You can email me at depthoffield@thedigitaltrekker.com or go by our Facebook page. Drop by our iTunes feed as well. Go ahead and rate us or comment. This helps us by getting us in front of more listeners. Thanks for taking time and hanging out with us here at Depth of Field.